Can you please go? Oh, God, sorry. Would you? Okay, everybody. If we could all just start to move to our seats, please. That would be wonderful. We're slightly overrunning. Thank you, everybody. I've probably buggered up the recording. He's your chair, yeah. Sorry, what? If you're doing slides and stuff, then there's a... Anybody doing slides? Okay. Okay, everybody, we're about to start the final session, so can we please sit down? I'm not having trouble, it's always like this. People are just bloody obedient. Thank you all. So we're just going to start the final session now of the afternoon. And can those people at the front please take a seat? So thank you all again. And I cannot believe quite how quickly this day has gone already. But here we are at the final session already. And so I'm going to hand straight back over now to Colin to chair the final session. Thanks.
Thanks very much. So we have strayed into Caribbean time, I'm afraid. So I'm not going to interrupt any of the presentations with my own questions to allow you all to ask questions at the end. And I think also I'm going to run through and introduce all of the panel. On my immediate left is Caroline Russell, who's part of the London Assembly. She's the Green Party Councillor for Highbury East Ward, Islington, and Chair of Assembly Environment Committee. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Very good. Formerly an artist, aren't we all? And Art College lecturer, Caroline, retrained as a civil engineer. In fact, we've all become artists today. I certainly become a poet in my little session. Thank you very much. I used to write really tedious poems when I was at medical school because we had a surgeon called Rita Auden, who was the grandniece of Dowitch Auden, and she was she specialised on thyroidectomies, which took forever. So she insisted that you would come to theatre. It's 4-hour surgery. Come to theatre with a poem. So we had to write really long, tedious poems. Now, Caroline's also been a school governor. I'm almost there. Okay, coming up to speed now. In 2011, which wasn't that so long ago, you helped a kind of first citizen science project revealing levels of pollution on Blackstock Road. Anyway, you're going to talk about how to make cities beautiful, aren't you?
Or make them work.
Good. Next to Caroline is Toby Miller, who's a distinguished professor of the Graduate Division, University of California, Riverside. But the thing I want to say about Toby was that I read today an extraordinary essay he wrote in the Los Angeles Review of Books, which is one of the subtitles is Cisco and Microsoft, the part they played in my downfall. And he ends by saying, quite rightly, that it was adequately extraordinary, is the essay. And he'll explain more, I hope, as we progress. And besides Toby, we have Paula Graham-Gazzard, is a consultant specialising in digital culture, policy, strategy. She's worked in the mainstream media and digital industries before founding Fosbox in 2007. Which works on translating cultural research into real-world impacts with universities, civil society, and arts organizations. Paula presently is the director of... well, she was previously responsible for policy and external relations at the Council for Higher Education, Art and Design until 2017. What are you working on now currently? Contemporary visual art. Great. Well, I'm sure Paula will explain more. But we're going to begin very promptly with Caroline.
Thank you. You've got 6 minutes.
Yeah.
Will you give me a 5-minute warning, please? Make that move down. Yes, so hello everybody. I'm Caroline Russell. I am a Green Party London Assembly member, which means I am one of the 25 politicians elected by Londoners to make sure that the Mayor of London is doing what he said he'd do in his manifesto and that his policies are as good as they possibly can be for the benefit of all Londoners. Now, over the last year, I have been chair of the Assembly Economy Committee, which for someone who's an artist who then retrained as a civil engineer was quite a sort of stretch. But luckily, all the mayor's strategies were coming out and we reviewed the culture strategy, the economic development strategy and the nighttime economy strategy. And that's broadly the work that I'm going to talk about now. So London is the most amazing city. It's massive. It's got 33 boroughs, each of which, you know, functions like a sort of a fairly decent-sized smaller city. And so in City Hall, we are trying to make sure that the Mayor of London is not leaving anyone behind. We've got a city with massive, massive challenges, rocketing costs of housing, terrible congestion, air pollution, desperate poverty, kind of incredible wealth at the other extreme. And a city that is struggling after years and years of very, very severe austerity cuts, so that I'm also a councillor in Islington. And, you know, the impact on these 33 boroughs in London trying to deliver services for Londoners is absolutely shocking. Things are so threadbare now that the safety nets are all completely shredded. So the economic development strategy, the culture strategy, the nighttime economy strategy, what has come out of our scrutiny of those strategies is the need for an absolute mission focus as a city. We can't just tackle poverty or just tackle housing. We can't or just tackle transport. Everything interlinks very, very tightly. And what is interesting about what the mayor is trying to do with his culture strategy and with his economic development strategy is to try and make those cross-cutting connections. And the problem comes when the different things that the mayor wants to achieve, the different outcomes, kind of start pulling against each other. So, for instance, I've been working with communities over in Hackney Wick trying to prevent the demolition of Victoria Wharf, which is an amazing building full of creative people, sort of artists and kind of designers and various other kind of, it's a low-cost art workspace. And unfortunately for Victoria Wharf, there's a pedestrian and cycle bridge that connects the Olympic Park to Fish Island and then on to the A12. And the developers of the Olympic Park want to make that into a proper road. And so the Mayor of London is kind of not really standing in the way of this being turned into a proper road, but that's going to make a rat run running through a very quiet, walkable neighbourhood, which is low on air pollution, a pleasant place to be, somewhere where young children, older people, people of all ages can get about on foot, on bikes and in safety. So the mayor has a healthy streets strategy, but he also has strategies to get lots of new housing built. And in a case like Victoria Wharf, that's where you get the crunch, because the mayor wants the developers to keep building the homes, but at the same time, he's got policies that are all about making sure that it's safe for people to walk and cycle. And that's the tension that happens in a city when you are trying to deliver for everyone and to get all these good outcomes. Another example is Earl's Court, where they demolished the whole Earl's Court Exhibition Centre. This was under Boris Johnson, without thinking that all around Earl's Court there is a network of hotels, cafes, restaurants, bed and breakfasts that have built up over the years to service all the people who were going to Earl's Court for the exhibitions, the shows, all the stuff that used to happen there. And those businesses just had the rug pulled out from them in one fell swoop as the developers came in and were able to take away the footfall, the people who created their livelihoods. So I suppose what I'm just trying to say is that there's a real tension in the city as the tsunami of glass and steel that is waving across London, stretching out from the city and stretching out from the centre. It's having massive, massive impacts on people's ability to just simply get by and earn a living. One of the other things that is happening in our city is that technology is changing very, very rapidly. How many have I had, like 3 minutes? How many?
Two more.
Fantastic. Technology is changing very, very rapidly. And we've had, one major technological shift, which was Uber coming to London. And TfL, that's the mayor's transport body, completely dropped the ball. So there are now so many licensed minicabs working with Uber that there is massive congestion. The buses have got much more slowed down, so they're less attractive. So more people are tempted to go for that personal door-to-door Uber solution. And we end up in a vicious circle of more and more congestion and a city not working properly. We also, the same technology that is used for that Uber platform could be delivering a sort of more hybrid thing, more of a sort of halfway between a bus and a taxi type service, because the technology's there, it could do it. And it could be working in outer London, and it could be helping all the people where there is no public transport and dealing with those public transport deserts and therefore helping to clean up our air. So the point I'm wanting to make with this is that there's a real need for everyone to have public purpose at the absolute heart of everything they do, and particularly for policymakers. And I think that people, certainly, at Transport for London, have completely dropped that ball. They're about to drop another ball, which is with electric vehicle charging points. They're putting, Source London are putting this kind of diameter, this height off the ground, electric vehicle charging points onto pavements, onto the footway, instead of putting them in the carriageway in a parking bay on a pavement build-out. So pavement space, precious public realm, public space for people, is being co-opted by the vehicle manufacturers and the people who are, the motor industry, and making life. I have, there's a blind woman who lives in my ward who now finds herself navigating a sort of slalom of electric vehicle charging points and other kind of all the other kind of pavement infrastructure and clutter that there is. And Source London are just rolling these things out, and local authorities haven't woken up to it. And I'm making quite a lot of noise about this one, because I can just see a complete disaster of all our pavements all over London being taken over and co-opted for vehicles, when actually in London it's an absolute minority of Londoners who even have access to a car or van. So it's that kind of thinking about how do you make decisions for a city, and how do you notice the technological changes that are going to change the way that your city works, and make sure that you legislate or you regulate in time to make sure that you don't get accidental bad outcomes. I think that'll do. You can ask me lots more questions later.
It seems to me that a lot of what we were just told by Caroline, by the way, I live just off that park where the development is threatened. Uh-huh. Thank you so much for your interest. It really means a lot when somebody goes beyond North London. Exists. That when we think about questions such as environmental pollution, such as racism, such as sexism, all kinds of other ills in our society, I don't think illnesses that do. It's very, very difficult to connect all of those in a logical way that makes sense to people. And it seems to me that art is one of the ways in which this can happen, and art activism. And I want to give you an example that ties the story that was just outlined to you on your cell phones through to this question of the life of the commodity sign really quickly, to say that this could be an interesting model for all kinds of activism, or at least an instance. Okay, so the point of my saying, look how this legal medical advice is hidden in your phone, even though it's so spectacular and so dangerous. What else is hidden in your phone? Well, there are about 10 major inventions that go to make up your cell phone. 9 of them were funded by US taxpayers like me through the Pentagon. Everything, basically, in the internet, as you know, was funded by the Department of Defense in the United States. It's all Cold War inventions. The 10th and one of the important ones was funded by European taxpayers like you and me, because CERN was the other entity responsible for helping to manufacture the ideas that became cell phones that are smart. None of this came from the private sector. Absolutely nothing. Steve Jobs wouldn't have a clue. Bill Gates barely writes his name. These people profit on the backs of public endeavor, public enterprise, research, and art. But then if we take things a little further, we say, okay, this is all very fine and well, we understand that Pentagon's at the heart of all good things that we love, but where do all the bits and pieces for our cell phones come from? Many of you will be familiar with the civil war underway for years in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the fact that Congo is one of the only places in the world that contains coltan. Caltan is a mixture of elements absolutely crucial to all central processing units, okay? And hence, integral to the devices that you hold in your hand, and I do too. That coltan is a classic conflict mineral. It is the product of the experience of slavery, murder, rape, institutionalized mistreatment of others, because those are many of the conditions under which many of the people undertaking the mining that goes into these devices, after they've gone for smelting, after they've gone for manufacture, working under the most appalling conditions imaginable. And those who are not actually slaves are earning something like 50 cents a week. Okay? You may have seen these horror stories told on television. You may not. But for sure, there's nothing in your cell phone telling you about it. There's nothing in your cell phone telling you about the energy impost in the transportation that then moves the coltan to the smelters in China. There's nothing to tell you about the mistreatment of the women aged maybe 11 to 21, but technically 15 to 21, who come down from northern villages in China to work in the manufacturing sectors in the southeast of the country in order to make the actual devices that we all use and that many Chinese, of course, use. Then there is the transportation and energy implication of getting those to us. Then there is the refined legal advice that's the bare minimum that a company like Apple or Samsung or whoever it might be is prepared to give in terms of the point where most of us come into play, namely as users. And then there's the question of e-waste, electronic waste or recycling. The part of East London that you were talking about used to be known as the Fridge Mountain. Does anyone remember when it was the Fridge Mountain of Europe? Right, a couple of you. Now, of course, the earth's been boiled twice and it's beautiful and my daughters love to play in it. But boy, was it a dangerous place for the migrant and working class communities that populated it for so very long before gentrification took over. But electronic waste, I mean, that's really electrical waste. Electronic waste is a big problem, not so much here in Britain, but exported elsewhere. And although India and China are now the major centres for the consumption, of course, of smartphones, they're also major centres for their illegal export and dangerous recycling, as is West Africa, as is Brazil, as is Colombia, and many other parts of the world. Most of this is entirely unknown to us, just as there is this fetish that simply makes the device exciting, fun, new, built in obsolescence, admittedly, but always requiring of something else to be added to it by our purchasing. So, although regulation comes into play and we are informed about some of the health risks, but only at the end of the story and in a very minor and somewhat hidden way, so the fetish absolutely excludes the minerals extraction, the smelting, the manufacture, and the post-consumption recycling story of the device. So it seems to me that in order to be politically responsible citizens and genuinely cosmopolitan, in order to make common cause with our sisters and brothers in all those parts of the world I mentioned, which many of us may come from or may live in or have experience of, I may be referring to things that you know about very well, but family members of yours have experienced or whatever, that you know more about than I do. But most of us are not aware of making these connections in the life of the commodity sign and tracking where and how it comes to be. So the very end, I guess I'm probably at my point of finish, not one bit great. Thank you. There are real signs of hope. There is a massive transnational movement among women, many of them analphabetic, in South America, in India, some in China, but more difficult there, who are involved in the informal sector of electronic recycling, who meet under the auspices of some Brazilian and Colombian women on an annual basis where possible, sometimes electronically, sometimes in person, who try to raise the consciousness of policymakers, regulators, and others where they live, and frequently do so by making great art. Similarly, there are great artists all over the world, maybe some in this room, I don't know, who make earrings and necklaces and all kinds of beautiful objects from electronic waste, from recycled pieces of our cell phones, our laptops, our televisions, and so on, and draw attention to the reality of the e-waste dumping that goes on in the world, the fastest growing municipal dumping problem in the globe, at the same time as creating things of great beauty. And it's that kind of message of trying to work out where all these things come from, where they travel, how we use them, what they do to us, and what happens after we dispose of them, as well as, of course, questioning who the we is in this story, there are a lot of people who look a lot like me on these walls, that I think is absolutely crucial in order to try to think of a more positive future in terms of the human intersection and the environmental intersection with the objects with which we work and play. Thank you.
Thank you for that illuminating and sensitising us to our complicity in this problem. Thank you for that. So we're going to end now with Paul.
Yeah, that'd be great. I have got some slides, but if it's difficult, it only waste too much time.
You might sit over here.
Sit over there. Yeah, I've got them on my tab as well. I'll just read them off the tab. No, you're right, it won't. And a tap will advance it, won't it?
Just this, yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay. Excellent. Okay, I'm going to talk about reimagining regions, which has quite a resonance for me at the moment because I've just started a new job, which has brought me into unexpected and unusual contact with the regions. I've worked in London probably most of my adult life, and if not in London, in some other capital city. So I was actually kind of hazy about what goes on in the regions or even what a region is. So I now know that there are 9 of them in the UK, and they're big. CVAN is a federated regional network. I've just started the Contemporary Visual Arts Network. I keep saying I've just started. I've actually been there for 6 months. We represent the visual arts in the UK. We have a network of regional organisations which do a lot of development regionally. So each of the 9 regions will have a CVAN, which works with local arts organisations and artists and works closely with the Arts Council to basically develop the visual arts in the region. It's funded by the Arts Council. Have I hit the wrong button? What have I done? Ah! No, I've just hit it twice now. Right, okay. So, what I'm finding myself kind of eventually doing is sort of dealing with England as a north, a middle, and a south kind of thing, with sort of western bits involved in each of these regions. So the Northern Powerhouse really hasn't done what one might hope. I think the headline really is that the GVA per capita in the North East is about half that of London, which is a bit surprising really, isn't it? But then just as you're weeping into your cornflakes, it kind of made me jump slightly that Sheffield has an economy the size of Ghana, which kind of puts it slightly in perspective. It's kind of fascinating really once you get into this. The North East has been growing at about twice the speed of London over the past few years, possibly the Northern Powerhouse, who knows. But the concerns are, as I'm sure all of you are aware, that the North East is most likely to be hit really badly by Brexit, so we don't know what's going to be going on. But it's incredibly important to rebalance the regions, as I'm sure you've been hearing, and especially in the wake of Brexit, the government sort of appears to be biting down this in a somewhat more serious way than it has done hitherto. So eventually, if it agrees to change the... Oh, good grief. I always want to go two at once. Right, OK. There's also a regional imbalance in arts funding. London hosts one of the 3 global arts market hubs. And actually, I haven't looked at this donut for quite a long time. I pulled it up just to put together this presentation and thought, because we used to be much better than that. China used to be almost not there. But we are still a significant global arts hub, which means that art sucks into London, basically, and it's very difficult to sell artwork anywhere else. So the art sector kind of falls into what the government calls the non-market sector, which is the portfolio organisation, which is the big art centres and galleries, and the commercial. And the commercial hub is ineluctably in London. And people have done all kinds of things to try to develop regional art markets. And, I mean, given that Singapore struggles to develop an arts market, what chances has Middlesbrough got?
Just that diagram, really. What No, we mean the value. Yeah, sorry, I do policy, it's always, you know, gross value and how much basically ka-ching.
This would be visual arts. It's the art what people call the art market. A lot of that will be sort of old masters and so on, but a portion of it is contemporary arts, and contemporary arts are becoming more important because the arts market in general is expanding and it's being financialised. Because the value of an artwork is highly speculative, it's very easy to financialise. And what's happening now is that, I'm diverging from my regional doodle, but what's happening now is that artificial intelligence is now moving into that financialised sector, and that's going to be quite interesting. But contemporary visual arts is located in the non-market sector, so this is kind of something I sort of need to know but isn't kind of hugely germane to my existence. In terms of regional, the key problem is that it means that all the commercial money related to art runs through London and it is almost impossible to make it do anything else, basically. It's not going to happen. The industrial strategy has pledged $3 million for creative industry development in the north. Actually, that's just been released through the Arts Council in a way that is going to make it extremely difficult for anyone who is not a fairly large and substantial organisation that's already active in the sphere to actually get any of it, unfortunately. So we'll see. Regional identity politics are also kind of like more interesting than I thought, in a scary kind of a way. So each of the regions has its own culture and histories, which I suppose is like blindingly obvious, but actually once you kind of start to grapple with it, is less obvious than you might think. In the context of Brexit, all of this has suddenly become incredibly visible to the rest of the country, basically, because I think if you lived in the south, you know, you might frequently visit the north because much of it is very beautiful, but I think people were kind of like, everybody knew there was post-industrial problems, blah, 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 but I don't think anyone was really hugely engaged in the southeast. I think what's happened now is that the Brexit vote has suddenly brought this into extremely sharp focus, but without any actual understanding of it, which is kind of interesting. One of the things that kind of struck me when I was in Manchester Art Gallery recently is that they were telling me they'd been picketed for showing work by Muslim artists. They'd actually had neo-fascist groups outside attempting to prevent people from going in and out of the gallery on a significant Muslim work, which is kind of the inversion of my understanding of identity politics when I was younger. So there's now a major question floating through the regions, is how do we re-engage? How on earth do we re-engage? And there's been a lot of really interesting work. One of the things that I absolutely love, and not just because I'm based at Baltic Mill, but as you know, Baltic Mill put together the Great Festival of the North, which is part of the government's strategy for the North. And this is the top floor of Baltic Mill at the moment. It's an exhibition called Idea of North, and I just loved it to bits. It's fantastic. As you come in, you see a lot of sort of mad 60s regen sort of projects that never got built kind of thing, but they're fascinating now as historical objects. Some of them included covering the Thames with a deck. Not the Thames. Yeah, regional, new to me. Covering the Tyne with a deck, with the boys from the Mersey and the Thames and the Tyne. and then you kind of go on to you can see where it says deck, it's looking at that project too. Then up behind that dome there's a lot of work around reminding us that Marx actually wrote his original work in Manchester about the condition of working people in Manchester. Right up at the top behind the dome there's a little sort of living art thing about various contributions of the North. And there's work around the rave culture of the 90s in Cumbria. In the middle is, and this is the kind of key thing in terms of reimagining in many ways, because the North has always been associated with materials of one sort or another, so that would be fabrics, you know, textiles, coal, steel, iron. And every single one of those triangles in the geodesic dome is made of a new technology, high-tech material. And the theme inside is how we're reinventing
the north as a hub of materials into a new age. And actually, for me, this really did actually blow me away in a kind of, you know, it really is a significant reimagining. And for the people who are walking around it, you could see it was really kind of, you know, it meant something. It's kind of amazing. So, 1 minute, okay, right. So, yeah, just talked about that for God knows how long. This is another of the Sevan regions in another place, which was basically posters. They were putting artworks on posters, recent local artists' work on posters to reach out to new audiences. A lot of really interesting stuff going on at Heart of Glass and similar organisations in Liverpool, which this was St Helens was a glass producing, and still is actually. Pilkington and so on are still up there. But they've been doing a lot of work around regenerating that area in true with the theme of glass. And again, we come back to materials in the north. So focus on R&D has not had the expected effect on innovation and economic value. In other words, as you know, my job was making research do something kind of thing, and actually research on the whole isn't doing much more than it was when they started trying to make it do something, if you see what I mean. So they've now realised that they actually need to make it more demand-led. Now, this is making everyone feel that they're being frog-marched around by neoliberal sort of jackboots, but actually, I'm a bit of a socialist and jobs person, and honestly, I can't see anything that bad with demand-led research, actually. Kind of not entirely, not working for me. We need to understand and communicate how engagement with the arts adds social value. The government is complaining that it doesn't really understand. It's not arguing that it does add social value, but it just would like to know how it adds social value so that it can bottle it, presumably, and, you know, get on with it. Focus on what we can do to add to emerging sectors and social challenges. So I notice that the green economy is not really getting mentioned an awful lot in all this. Everyone's gone to the industrial strategy, which says, you know, health and well-being is about the only thing that looks as if it has enough purity for us to wish to, you know, engage with. But actually, I think that the green economy is something that we really should be looking at, how arts and culture can contribute to that. AI, and I say this because I'm currently involved in a project, because it's been a bugbear of mine for years, how civil society is being undermined or potentially added to, or, you know, but basically the... how AI is reshaping the civic world. That has been my, you know, and you couldn't get anyone to listen for the last 10 years, and now suddenly it's, you know, everywhere and everything.
Can we explore further as a group? Because we're going to really run out of time. So.
Yeah, I'll just leave that up there, basically.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Reasons are hard.
Place called the Arts Guild. Everything, the Arts Workers Guild. Everything is very artisanal and sort of small scale. And do you think in 2018 that with the dominance of the global monopolies like the Facebooks and the Googles and whatnot, there's a place for ordinary people to engage with the artisanal, or ordinary people, i.e., working class people, just at the mercy of the big bastards? That's my question. And does, you know, the artisanal remains the place just for the nice middle class people like me?
Robber barons are not a new construct, really, are they? Let's face it. I mean, you know, actually, in many people's eyes, what we're seeing is another industrial revolution. And it is unfolding in much the same way as the previous one did, i.e. somewhat violently and with, you know, major winners and losers, concentration of wealth, etc. How you tackle that is obviously a long, slow process. So I'm seeing a serious revival of unionisation. And actually, amongst the nice middle class artisanal people, there's a lot of emphasis on unionising with varying degrees of success. But I'm involved in at least two projects that involve trying to unionise the precariat, for example. But that's in the backdrop of unions in general globally, as well as regionally, beginning to sort of, you know, sputter back into action. So basically, the only response to that, you know, if you look at history, the way to go is to organise, you know, organise, criticise, engage. And not be going, oh, they're going to make us, you know, don't do that, people, you know. Organise, engage analytically with what's in front of you. Don't keep pointing back to William Morris, because I'm going to scream. And go forward.
Right, yes. Just a quick comment in general about these things. It seems to me there's a big problem with a kind of leftist functionalism, right? By which I mean pointing to the extraordinary concentration of media ownership and the big bastards that you were referring to. I'm sorry. Sorry, your important partners, big bastards, in which they're all powerful, they're omnipotent, omniscient, and all the rest of it. Okay, and on the other hand, there's a, and this to me is a bad Marxism because it isn't conflict-based. It doesn't allow for the warp and woof of contradiction and so on. Conversely, there can be a kind of happy, snappy, I am magically the grassroots because I dress up funnily and climb a building that somebody else owns and call myself a green. Lowercase g, that with all its, you know, imagined power to the people is actually about middle class self-formation much of the time. And it seems to me both these antinomies, even if they're caricatures on my part, need mixing, need reform by mixing. So they definitely need, on the one hand, to have people who look at ownership and control and the power of big corporations and the state to realise that these things often involve massive contradictions, like the one you pointed out when it comes to wanting a greener, better transported London while also needing more housing, and that those can be productive as well as destructive, and that on the side of the, you know, all power to the people because we can use social media or whatever, in fact there are major structural obstacles to expression of our power as a consequence of these other questions. On the very, very quick response though to your query, the slide that you put up that included the nature of the art market, one could make a similar slide probably about various art institutions around the world that wouldn't be about the monetary value of the exchange of hanging art, the plastic arts, which I assume is the basis of the art market model that you're, and as are we all, working with, but that would look at the social backgrounds of the people who go to many of our major cultural institutions. And that would suggest that there are real barriers in racial, class and immigrant terms to the sense of places really being welcoming to people. And there are regional barriers too that, you know, you're addressing.
Yeah, I would just quickly like to put into that that we have audience data, which I'm going to work with the audience agency to put into a report, which will be coming out in a few months. The early indications are that actually visual arts is far more diverse in its audiences than any other of the Arts Council's portfolios. So we're very pleased with that. Where the problem lies, actually, is in the workforce. So the workforce is the workforce that's... but actually, we have the youngest audiences and the most diverse, because that goes with younger in general, actually. Anything that appeals to younger people is prone to be more diverse, because the younger generations in this country are more open,
yeah,
basically.
I wasn't referring to Britain. I was referring to... Right, I was referring to a pie chart like that that would be for the whole world. Do you know what I mean? Where there are major problems.
I'm sorry, so much since your question. Could you just remind me of exactly what you said when you were when you first spoke?
The great unwashed, most people aren't able to engage with small things that people make anymore, are they? Because we just want to get cheap stuff that's made, you know, en masse, don't we? Like that shirt. Not that shirt, my shirt.
Well, the best thing to do is to get your clothes in the second-hand shop. future. But the, I think, I'm speaking as a London politician here, and we have a huge, huge problem in London of rocketing costs of spaces to work. And the London Plan, which is the mayor's way of protecting affordable workspace, is kind of struggling against, you know, these big, big businesses who are wanting to just develop and sweep away all the existing communities. So, for instance, what the example I gave you of Earl's Court, where the whole of the exhibition space just disappeared. Well, the developers had no actual plan for what they were going to put in its place. And there's been this community is left with an absolute vacuum at its heart. And I think it's what we have to do is absolutely organise, as you were saying. And I think, you know, I've done a lot of work with a union that's representing Uber drivers, because they, Uber have not an ounce of public value about them, but they have exploited both our city and also exploited the drivers who were working for them. And I had people telling me how they had been encouraged by Uber to take on a loan on a car, which they were then working incredibly long hours just to be able to pay the loan on the car before they paid their rent, put food on the family's table. It's absolutely shocking the levels of exploitation that are going on within the precarious workforce and the people who are working in the gig economy. And within the art world, there's an awful lot of exploitation going on. And one of the reasons we don't have diversity in terms of practitioners is because there are, you know, too much of the kind of getting on in the art world depends on being able to get some experience and, you know, survive and work unpaid and get things done. And I think, you know, one of the good things actually about the Mayor's Culture Strategy is that it does recognise that. And it is, you know, all the pushing for a living wage, or actually for a universal basic income, where everyone gets paid, given money every month by the government, which then allows you to contribute to community, contribute to society, to make things, to, you know, I mean, that's how we kind of overcome, you know, that's what we need to be fighting for.
Thank you. I think we're going to have to draw the conversation to a close. So I'm going to ask you to bring your hands together. Thank you, Caroline Russell, Tim Miller, Paul Dunbar. And I'm going to have a pleasure of yours.
Very much to do now, apart from to thank you, Colin, for chairing us through the afternoon so well. Thank everybody here today, all of our contributors, just brilliant food for thought, and for you all for being here today. It's 6:10. There is beer, wine, soft drinks as we move through to the second part of the evening. We're having book launch. So, I mean, I think there's been so much raised today, so many really, really interesting conversations. So I hope over the course of the next couple of hours, we're not going to get thrown out till about 8, that some of those cross-fertilisations and chats and conversations can continue next door or even here for a little while. So thanks all. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Evelyn, thank you so much. It's been great. I have to go, I know, because I've got to go to there's a Faber book launch that I have to go to. Because it's
I really love the novel by
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Yes. Yes. And oh, great. I'm really pleased. It was great to have the opportunity to do this walk. Well, I think so, because I think actually if I had an hour and a half to do it, it could take in Holborn Library and a couple of other locations. And count me in, because it's here, it's ready to go.
No, not waiting to be heard.
Now then the guy can take it
directly. Oh my God. It's Nicola.
You do know me? No. How fantastic. Yes. I think it's your voice. Your delivery as well. That's cool. And then I looked at the thing. Yes, it is Paula. Fantastic.
Oh, sorry, let me just give her a kiss.
I'm sorry. We've got to meet. Let's do that. Let's have a proper catch up.
Let's see him.
Yes, so good. Yes, lovely to see you. My husband died. He committed suicide.
But who was got to
the
Although, you know, I have to say, every time, because, you know, if you'd have spoken to me 5 years ago or 10 years ago, I'd be really enthusiastic about the idea of Great Britain, the North, and the culture, and all the rest of it. But every day that passes, and more kind of mountains than the more I start to think about the fact that that is, if you begin to have more and more separate from these people who are experiencing great communities, and actually, one of the things that was essentially going around last week to a couple of community projects that happened in our
Thank you. that will be the next one. Thank you.
So you need to do it.